You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, February 4th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Susan Eaton, author of Integration Nation, Immigrants, Refugees, and America at its Best. Just thought we'd sprinkle a little optimism. Mix it in with a melange of nativists and xenophobes that are welling up from the Republican portions of our country. Also on the program today, taxpayers bail a company out, then it bails out. Says, screw you, we're not paying taxes anymore. Not in this country. Meanwhile, irony gets its chance. Pro-rape men's rights group cancels a meetup because they're afraid of being assaulted. Meanwhile, former NAACP head endorses or to endorse Bernie Sanders. Meanwhile, Lloyd Blankenfein, not so much. Last night there was a forum. Tonight there's a debate. And on the Republican side, Jeb Bush falls apart.
Every time you feel bad, just remember what he said about Tamir Rice and Flint, and then you'll feel fine.
I don't really feel that bad.
Neither do I.
Meanwhile, Ben Carson slashes his campaign staff. My sense is he was actually going to quit in Iowa, and then the last minute changed his mind.
Ted Cruz has gotten me so angry, I am going to stab him and keep running.
Maybe
mean
if he doesn't.
And mean.
Maybe if he stops flying cross country every time he needs a fresh clothes, maybe that would save some money.
I don't like you either, Sam.
We have reached peak Trump supporter.
It also will help people from outside of Mass realize something about our state.
Right. Meanwhile, in Auckland, New Zealand, the TPP signed will give you the timeline of when it could come before Congress. Here's a hint. My guess is probably not until after the election. And Obama goes to a mosque and Rubio calls him a regressive. Not really. Folks, you know I'm not one to wallow in the misfortune of others. Well, I don't wallow in it. I think I bask in it. So I'm not one to wallow in the misfortune of others. I'm one to bask in the misfortune of others. Now, I don't even think that's true. It depends on who the other is. It's not like a blanket. It's not a blanket principle I have. However, no, I don't have a blanket principle of appreciating others' failures. There are just specific people.
As an example.
No, it's not that broad. I think that probably everyone who listens to this program could come up with the six people. I don't know if it's six off the top of my head, but I mean, I think it's around six, who instinctively they know I'm going to appreciate their misfortune. Right? Joe Lieberman.
Yes.
Chris Christie.
Andrew Cuomo.
Well, why don't you step on the reveal, buddy?
I'm sorry. I thought you were going into it. You know what? I actually got genuinely confused because I thought you were going into another piece of Schadenfreude, not that one. I apologize.
Well,
go ahead.
Who was the other Schadenfreude for?
Well, I don't want to step on that one either.
Well, now it's too late.
Okay, there was a moment in New Hampshire that I thought you might have been building up towards.
Oh, what, the Jeb Bush?
Yes.
Well, no, I mean, yeah, I'm not. Okay. You can tell because I headlined that already.
All right. Oh, all right. God.
Do you bask in?
I'm adding Michael to that list. So, ladies and gentlemen, I saw this piece, and, it brought a smile to my face, and I thought maybe it would do the same for you. After dismal sales and tepid reviews, Governor Andrew Cuomo's memoir won't be published in paperback. Oh, shoot. You know what I should have done? I should have already had this set up.
It makes it even funnier. He's so giddy from his pleasure and his misfortune. He's unfocused.
There you go. That's wompwompwomp.com. I've used that almost multiple times a day since I found it. After dismal sales and tepid reviews, it won't be published in paperback. The decision by Mr. Cuomo's publisher, HarperCollins, isn't unexpected. The hardcover edition of All Things Possible, Setbacks and Successes in Political Life, suffered anemic sales. You'll recall, and I believe, and I did not read it, but I'm pretty sure, he said, you know, it was a real curse to have Cuomo as a last name because I inherited all his enemies and none of his friends, in speaking about his father, showing that he is at least one of the most deluded human beings in the country. I mean, maybe, or at least in politics, at least that you can read about. The idea that Andrew Cuomo, or frankly, with all due respect to Chris Cuomo, would be names that we would ever even heard of as governor or CNN host, were it not for the fact that their father was governor of New York, is ridiculous. My understanding is that Andrew Cuomo is an epic a-hole. But I don't know. That's all secondhand. I've never met the man.
No, it's true. It's true.
Since its release in October of 2014, it has sold about 3,000 copies. And I mean, that's not.
That is the book sale equivalent of a Gilmore voter. I want to do an anthro study of who bought those books.
I think FUBAR. I haven't checked on the numbers in literally in years, but I think it was around 15 or 20, I think, over the course of its life. It's five times more than him.
Well, yeah.
And it was also a HarperCollins release, if you can believe it. As of now, we don't have any plans for a paperback, said Tina Andrea Dridias, implying that it's possible in the future. But I'm going to make a bold prediction. They'll never have plans to release it. The book sales proved low, not only with respect to Cuomo's position as a prominent elected official and member of a political dynasty, but also in the context of the lucrative terms of his contract with the publishing house. According to people familiar with the deal, his advance was $1 million. And I will tell you something, folks. My advance was not $1 million. Not even close. All right, but that brings a smile to my face. We're going to take a quick break. Just a reminder, this program exists because of our members. When you become a member of the Majority Report, what you do is you support the daily free show. And then as a way of saying thank you to you, we give you an extra, basically an extra show every day. So you pick and choose. Today I don't feel like an interview. Today I feel like hearing what it would sound like if Nelson Mandela was in some way, somehow, genetically crossed with Donald Trump. No, don't. They got to listen to the membership.
It's true.
Michael, we're it's trying fantastic. To put Michael on a diet right now, and he's basically only allowed to do Trump if he does it in a
normal voice.
In a normal voice.
Join, no, it's actually fantastic.
Join themajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. If you buy your crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. But also, folks, we now are a jet.com affiliate. That means that you can buy your stuff from jet.com, do it through our link, we get a kickback. That's also at majorityreportkickback.com. First-time buyers, I think, are getting a 15% discount right now. So check it out. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Susan Eaton, author of Integration Nation, Immigrants, Refugees, and America at its Best. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program the director of the Silliman Center and a professor at the Heller School located at Brandeis University. She's author of Immigration Nation, Immigrants, Refugees, and America at its Best. Susan Eaton, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So I your book is well timed based upon what is going on, at least in the electorally and depending on when it rears its head legislatively in this country. But I mentioned it earlier in the program as a slight corrective to the sense that we get in this country. And I would say, you know, also with the events of what we saw with the children and families coming up from Central America over, I guess it was now last summer, but that continue to come in to escape violence in their countries. And of course, the Syrian refugee question that became highly politicized. But let's start with, I mean, there's a couple of things I really want to get to, but let's start with just the idea of of integration as opposed to assimilation. What does that mean when we say when we differentiate those two dynamics and give us a sense of what has been predominant at different times throughout our history, if you could.
Sure, absolutely. And these two words, this isn't a matter of merely semantics. It's a matter of what things actually look like and whether or not they work on the ground. So we're not using a particular word necessarily to be politically correct, but these different words mean different things. Okay, so assimilation, as you implied before, basically all it means is that it's the kind of phenomenon that happens when people come to this country from other countries and they absorb all of the culture and habits and prevailing ideas and practices that the prevailing culture here in the United States might have. And so this would be an example of, you know, telling students who came to the United States who spoke Italian, you know, don't speak Italian. Now you're here to learn English. You will not speak Italian. We do the same things to Spanish-speaking students now. Integration is something different. Integration is the practice of saying immigrants are here. They're going to be changed by being here and by the culture that exists in the United States, the prevailing dominant culture, but we too should be open to changes as well. And we should respect the differences that exist in immigrant communities, and we should be open and learn about those. And that includes everything from languages, from different cultural habits, from worship, from different ways of celebrating, a whole range of things. And one example I can give you just to make it a little bit more concrete, there's a first story in my book about Utah, which saw a huge migration of Latinos, oftentimes from other states, but originally from Mexico for the most part, coming into what was a historically white state. And at first, educators there did what educators in a lot of places do. They separated the students who spoke Spanish from the students who spoke English. And there were kind of two parallel education systems going on. In time, the educators realized this is not working for the Latino students or for the white students. And so they decided to create voluntary programs that brought Spanish-speaking students together with the native English-speaking students to learn each other's languages and to be taught the material in two different languages. They've become not only successful in terms of academic achievement for both groups of students, but incredibly popular among both the white parents and the Latino parents. And they've spread, and a lot of other states are looking to replicate those now.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because in New York, anyways, we do have at some public schools that dual language programs. I mean, they're predominantly Spanish and English, but some are French and whatnot, and they tend to mix or they want to mix basically people who are speaking Spanish at home and people who are speaking English at home into one classroom. But let me get back to those sort of two general concepts. I mean, have we really ever had a time? I mean, have we ever really had a time where we have really asked for assimilation as opposed to integration, or should I say, when we've actually experienced full assimilation as opposed to integration, broadly speaking? And by that, I mean, it seems to me, yes, particularly when various people from European countries have come to this country, they have been asked to, there's been this pressure to speak English. There hasn't been an opportunity to have like a dual language Italian class. I mean, and one would anticipate, though, that you're going to have something different for people in your hemisphere on one level. But, I mean, haven't we also then, I mean, in terms of like what we eat, what we listen to, what we consume has all been impacted, it seems to me. What we wear has been impacted by immigrants.
That's so true. That's so right. And people forget that, because over time, what immigrants bring, whether it's food traditions, worship traditions, clothing everywhere, music, so many cultural contributions have been made, you know, throughout the generations and have really shaped the cultural landscape of our country and provided enormous contributions that aren't always recognized. And that's a really good example of, you know, how integration has really taken place. And I guess the difference between the integration that I'm talking about is more about a deliberate type of, you know, having government think in terms in the same way that, you know, culturally our nation has, you know, practiced integration, you know, as an individual level, right, and appreciated those things. I think now the attention is said, okay, well, how can government also do that? How can educators and people and social institutions who are putting programming in place, educational initiatives, health initiatives, and so that's the difference there. But I think that example that you give is a perfect example of the way that we all influence each other. the receiving community that where immigrants decide to settle, or refugees where refugees are settled, is affected by immigrants, and immigrants are affected by the community. It's a two-way kind of process.
So if we have this dynamic where, and we've always had this sort of like, you know, this, our culture has been influenced by immigration, but what you're presenting in your book are different examples, localized in many respects. I mean, some is statewide, but some is many municipal. Localized examples of policy that is focused on this, that is adopting this as an official policy. On one hand, we have that inclination, right, where we have sort of progressed to the point where there could actually be policies that sort of say, like, you know, this is going to be better for everybody. I mean, it's going to be better for the Caucasian kids, and it's going to be better for the Latino immigrants. I mean, because, you know, it's great to learn another language. I mean, it's good for everybody here. But there's also, it seems, sort of concurrent. I mean, within our country, that this rise of policies that are oriented towards integration is the worst thing that could possibly happen. I mean, this is what, like, Patrick Buchanan was warning, half the country about, maybe fortunately closer to 45%, about, 30 years ago, and what Donald Trump is talking about, right? It's the whole notion of, like, we're not becoming we're losing our fundamental American character.
Well, exactly. I mean, the stories in this book are the counterexample to that. And I think the proof that the xenophobia is not only, you know, deeply anti-American in every possible way, but also the idea that this changing and this transformation, whether it's cultural or political, is somehow bad, is just wrong. Immigration, you know, in every way that you look at it, every piece of data, is something that confers huge benefits to the country in a variety of ways. And the stories that I have from across the country, or that I've collected from across the country, the people whose voices I'm trying to amplify are people who understand that and who act on that knowledge. But you're right. I mean, there has always been in this country, and I think that there always will be, a kind of, two impulses, not to simplify it too much, because there is nuance as well. But at the extremes, there is the impulse to welcome and to integrate and to allow oneself and one's policies to be shaped and be responsive to cultural and other kinds of demographic changes that are going on. And then the impulse to reject, to shut down, and to exclude. So those two extremes, inclusion and exclusion, have always existed in our politics. This is not a new thing. You'd think that we would have learned now, right, by now, that the policy of xenophobia and exclusion is not a positive policy and does not work for everybody. But the fact of the matter is, it does exist, and it's always going to have to be something that's fought against on the one hand, but on the other hand, we also have to have a sense, a really concrete idea of exactly what we're fighting for and what a vision of inclusion might look like on the ground.
Yeah, I don't want to get ahead of myself because I and maybe what we should do is go through a couple of those examples. There's a couple that I really want to touch on, but I am. And we should say, let's start with this, because I want to get to that question as to why you think or how it is or what is, because you were on the ground talking to people really across the country and a real mix of people ranging from, sort of on the ideological, secular, religious spectrum, who are implementing these positive policies. And I want to swing back around and ask you, was there a thing that differentiated between people who seemingly have on paper could just as easily have that attitude of like, this is going to ruin America versus this is a good policy for everybody. But before we get to that, let's talk about a couple of examples. Let's start in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Just tell us about what you saw there.
Yes, Fort Wayne, Indiana is a really fascinating place. It's a very Indiana is an extremely conservative state, and Fort Wayne has, has one of the highest numbers of churches, right, in the city limits per square feet or per square mile than any other major city in the United States. So it's a very conservative state and it's a very religious state, and Fort Wayne does reflect that. That said, Fort Wayne has also, like a lot of post-industrial areas, its downtown has suffered a decline in recent years. But while it was experiencing this decline because of a loss of jobs, a loss of manufacturing, et cetera, there were large numbers of both immigrants and then refugees who were settling in the city of Fort Wayne. Okay, and these included people from Mexico and Guatemala, and it also included people from Burma, from Sudan, so a highly diverse population.
Now, why Fort Wayne? Why Fort Wayne? Just explain to us.
Well, that's really interesting. So, Fort Wayne was a center and still has some job availability, especially in past decades. So the Latino population, the migration there, is a little bit older, that population. But as far as why refugees, particularly from Burma and some African countries, were settled in Fort Wayne, a combination of things. One is the strong presence of the Lutheran Church there and other churches that worked and helped to settle refugees. So there was that presence there. And the mayor of Fort Wayne has also worked to make the city a welcoming place. And so in that sense, the city services are pretty responsive in terms of what refugees and newcomers need and what will help them prosper. And so there were a variety of factors, but refugee resettlement and why people get settled in different places is complicated. but in the case of Fort Wayne, that was the situation. Now, there was in the city of Fort Wayne a beautiful old theater called the Rialto Theater, which was built originally by a Greek immigrant. And it had fallen into disrepair over the years, had been changed hands several times, and was kind of a symbol for a lot of people in the city of kind of a depressing symbol about, Fort Wayne's glory days had gone by. Well, there was a young woman there, a young mom there, who had grown up in Fort Wayne and had recently moved back from California. And while she was in California, one of the things she discovered was that she really loved and enjoyed the diversity that existed in California, in large part as a result of immigration that had happened around the places where she had lived. And she also loved old buildings. And she said, I would love to do something with that theater someday. Somebody should really do something with it. And so she ended up speaking to a lot of fellow members at her church, and they got together and decided that they would renovate the theater. They would try and raise money to renovate the theater, but to make it specifically a place where immigrants could come to and refugees could come together with people who had lived in the city of Fort Wayne for a long time, had been born in the city of Fort Wayne. They could get to know each other through social events. And immigrants could also, and refugees could also at the same time receive a host of services that would help them integrate into the larger community. It's been a struggle to raise the money that was that's necessary to renovate this old building, but it is incredibly inspiring to see this activity and this spark of revitalization in this neighborhood, which is just a spectacularly diverse place. You know, across the street, there are some small businesses, some food oriented businesses started by Burmese people. There's a African American community not far away, and there's a pretty vibrant Latino community as well. And the hope is that this theater can be a kind of social space and an anchor for that community. And that's a very heartwarming, you know, story. And it's the type of thing that I think has a lot of potential. And similarly, in Hazleton, Pennsylvania, we saw after a very divisive fight that ended up, the city council ended up passing an ordinance that restricted undocumented immigrants' ability to rent apartments and to find employment and a variety of other things. And the whole thing was eviscerated by a court later on, but it caused a huge rift in the community. And the response from people on the ground, both white people and Latino people, was to create a shared space where children, the next generation specifically, could come together and get to know one another, and they could overcome some of the stereotypes and the misunderstandings that had been created through two groups. There's also services offered, and there's also ways for adults from both the white community and the Latino community to get together and just get to know each other and then work together to make the community safer, to make it more prosperous and more appealing for everybody.
How are opponents, I mean, you know, when you have a law like that passed in Hazleton, it's obviously a function of at least some popular sentiment. I mean, how did those people react to the sort of the pushback against, I mean, aside obviously when those laws are struck down through judicial system, how did the opponents or the proponents of that law respond to the sort of I guess the social or policy pushback once that law is repealed, more or less.
Once it's appealed?
No,
or once
repealed. Once that law goes away and you have this pushback.
Once it's repealed? Yeah, I mean, once it's repealed, it's repealed.
No, but I'm saying what happens in the community to those people who were proponents of that law? Like, you know, where does that go? I mean, where does that...
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I mean, I think it's interesting. You know, I don't really know the answer to that question specifically. But it's very interesting to see what happens when, say, a court strikes down one of these municipal laws. In the end, what happens is that a city, usually a very cash-strapped city, because this is where the conflicts arise, is people aren't doing well, they aren't being able to advance, and so they end up blaming the immigrants.
Right.
In the city, right? And so what happens is this money, which is hard to come by, is now spent on this fight defending this law, right? And so what I think happens in the end is that really the fire goes out of these opponents to immigration. But what's left with is a much smaller account to provide city services for everybody, basically. So it's something that hurts everyone. And then there's this rift left. And what I've seen just from, and I have to admit that I'm watching this all from afar, is the power of their argument and the kind of emotion that gets all, you know, built up and released during this fight to pass a provision like this kind of dies out. Right. And so people may still, you know, have anti-immigration sentiments, but I don't think it's as active and as necessarily vocal once this is all over. I mean, the results of something like this are always bad. And so we see more of the constructive forces in the community having to try and repair this mess that was created. And, you know, no good has come from any of these measures.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I ask that question specifically because I know that you've written about Boston's busing, and you know, from the 70s. I think most people are familiar, maybe they're not actually, that Boston public schools were under the jurisdiction of the courts, at least to the extent that there was desegregation. And, you know, I wonder if you had any insights as to just sort of like how people react, particularly on that level. I mean, you know, we can see examples of this, like, you know, I guess Roe v. Wade on a national level. But when these things are addressed by the courts rather than by, you know, sort of the political process in some way. And I wonder if it, in some instances, it diffuses this fervor because, like, you know, the courts decide, like, this is not American, what you're doing on some level, right? I mean, like, whether or not it can actually educate people to a different set of values.
Yeah, I mean, I think that courts still have a really, really important role to play in fighting against these kinds of things. And, you know, a true reading of the Constitution, I think, would say that, you know, many of these things are unconstitutional. And whether they are or whether they aren't, they're certainly, I would define them as un-American. But yeah, you're right. I mean, courts are limited in, you know, being able to necessarily change all hearts and minds. There have to be measures on the ground that increase community engagement, increase community education, in order for, you know, the courts, either enforcement or the court's mandates to have, you know, a long-term lasting impact. Courts can, you know, do things like, you know, force a conversation and force a change where real harm was being done to people, for sure. But you're absolutely right as far as that, you know, longer term healing and the longer term coalition building that, you know, can create lasting change over the long term, that people in a community are empowered to kind of shape their own lives. That has to happen on the ground, and that's why these small efforts that create a common space and encourage conversation and break down these barriers between people and between groups that are created for a variety of reasons and are exacerbated by the kind of a lot of the divisive rhetoric that we're seeing right now. These kinds of constructed efforts are really important right now.
Talk about Mississippi, because this is an example. I mean, I think this is an example of sort of more, I guess, political activism. I mean, this is all sort of in the wake of like SB 1070, right, passing in Arizona and then ultimately either being struck down. But it didn't. Something like that did not happen in Mississippi, which is a little bit counterintuitive. And your story also runs against the sort of the narrative that we're told that the immigration issue within the African American community is perceived as one that is, you know, a fundamentally economically threatening.
Yes, exactly. So Mississippi, so after Arizona passed its restrictive immigration law, SB 1070, that encouraged racial profiling, there were many very conservative state legislatures across the country, but particularly in the southeastern United States, that sought to come up with their own, you know, their similar laws. And again, this is a story of, for the most part, many of those laws were eviscerated by courts, but not all of them. People, pundits predicted that Mississippi would be among the first to implement one of these kinds of laws, and absolutely true to form. There were many conservative legislators within Mississippi who proposed such legislation. And to everybody's surprise, it never passed. And there were, you know, several reasons for why it didn't pass, but the strongest reason was because African American leadership in the state of Mississippi, African Americans who had fought for decades, as we know, to gain even a little bit of a foothold of power in a deeply conservative state, decided that they would absolutely take this issue on, protecting immigrants. Immigrants in Mississippi are relatively new to the state. They do not have formal political power or hold elective office. They do not have the same kind of voice, amplified voice, that an organization that African Americans had developed over many decades. But African Americans joined with Latinos, and it was very important, too, that they also joined with people in the state through who were working for fair wages and for a living wage in the state of Mississippi and other kinds of progressive policies. And they kept repeating the narrative over and over again. Yes, African Americans are working hard to even have a living wage in this state. We face discrimination. We face unfair labor practices, all kinds of challenges. But our fight is not with the newest members of our state. The fight is with the more powerful corporations and the conservative legislatures that are trying to take away rights and limit rights, right? And so what happened was, you know, there were a series of direct actions, and there was effort on the part of the state legislature, the Black Caucus, to band together against the immigration ordinances. And in the end, they ended up, the coalition ended up winning, and the laws have never passed. A lot of other bad laws in Mississippi, but this particular one, did not make it through, and we saw even in the states where the laws did pass, like for example in Alabama and South Carolina, one positive thing that did come out of all of this was that the alliances between African Americans and Latinos were strengthened. People began to see each other's, fight as their own fight. And that's a very powerful coalition. And if that coalition, that type of coalition, that lesson from that coalition can spread, I think that that will be tremendously powerful.
How much of, I mean, it seems to me, I mean, that the story of Mississippi is really fascinating to me. I mean, I wasn't aware of any of it, frankly. The idea that and maybe I'm projecting too much on this, and you tell me, and if there were other examples that you came across like this, but where sort of a clash consciousness overcame, you know, there's an attempt obviously to create an economic divisiveness, right? Like you guys are in competition for the same jobs here. But it seems like these leaders in the, at least, you know, these elected overcame that, I guess, tactic and sort of reframed it in the context of sort of more of a class battle.
Yes, I think that that's true. It was as an economic issue, but also as a human rights issue. Even though Mississippi is a deeply conservative state among progressives there, and obviously the very large African American population, the language of civil rights is still resonant. And so it was both of those things together, I think, a human dignity, an anti-racism, anti-xenophobic message, like racism and xenophobia come from the same bad place. There was a very overt recognition of that, and also that economic argument. And if I could, I'd love to read a quote from the book from Bill Chandler, who was the architect. He, a white man, longtime labor activist and executive director of the Mississippi Institute Immigrant and Refugee Rights Alliance in Jackson.
Please.
And he said, look, everyone needs to put food on the table. Everyone wants to walk down the street without getting harassed, Chandler says in Mira's Jackson office. Outside his door, Latino immigrants sit waiting for a workshop on the naturalization process. We need to respect the different histories here between groups, but the folks in that waiting room and the African Americans looking for a living wage, they are engaged in the same struggle, and it is not with each other.
Yeah, I mean, that's that I find really intriguing on some level, because that is where there's it's almost like three different types of sort of general macro stories here. You know, one is one that is sort of founded on a policy that is just perceived as, you know, sort of good governance, right? And they're going to have good policy outcomes. Is the impetus for this. The other is one that is almost sort of founded more in some measure of, if not charity as much as it is sort of human compassion. And then that third, which is, you know, this is a political movement, right? Like the, mm-hmm. that we have aligned political agendas here, and we can amplify our power by joining forces in some way.
That's right. Yes, that's absolutely true. I mean, each of these, if you look at each of these stories, right, they all come from a kind of a different sector, and oftentimes many different places.
Well, the book is Integration Nation, Immigrants, Refugees, and America at its Best. Susan Eaton, thank you so much for your time today. We'll put a link at majority.fm to your book.
Great. Thanks very much. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks. Going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program, wherein, what was I had another name for the lowbrow part of the program. I don't know if that's accurate. Is that underselling?
I think it's entirely accurate.
Well, I mean,
I don't really.
I don't like the
whole brow terminology. There's a problematic history behind that. If I could be highbrow for a second,
is that right?
Yeah, there actually is.
What is it?
There was some sort of racial orientations where that terminology comes from. Yeah, I am. So not good. Not good.
What is
really
the opposite
energy.
Of haute politics? What would that be? The like, if it's haute couture, what is the opposite of
the Denny's half?
Pas de haute couture?
The Denny's manager half.
I'm just thinking about, like, you know, I was thinking about, like, you know, branding it, like the fun half, because that implies that the first half is not fun. I mean, it's not as, generally not as fun.
I think we can be honest. Yeah.
But learning is fun.
Right.
Loser.
Well. All right.
Thing.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920 is the number. Yeah, I think lowbrow is actually works. We just got to come up with a not loaded term for that, I guess.
The lowbrow half does have a certain ring to it.
Yeah.
But
the Western Mass
half. No, Western Mass is definitely
folks,
more first half.
We've got two pieces of sound half. For you in the fun half that I think are transcendent. They really are transcendent. Let me tell you, I listened, and I imagine most of you heard it already, but we're obviously going to talk about it. But I listened to the Jeb Bush clap sound. And if you've heard it already, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't, you better stick around. I listened to it so many times. I came in this morning, and I thought that we had talked about it on the program, not just yesterday, like 3 days ago.
I think might have been thinking of the mission accomplished thing.
No, there's something
about it that so embodies everything that's happened in his campaign it feels like it's already existed.
I've actually I got my first, I think, my first unsolicited, what's the word I'm looking for? My first unsolicited concession from John Benjamin in an argument that I I've gotten, I think, in I maybe the first ever, and I've known the guy for. He called me up. He called me up. And it had to do with Jeb Bush. We will talk about that in the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. You, of course, can IM the show through our app, majorityapp.com. Oh, folks, don't forget, give us a review on iTunes. That makes a big difference. Makes a big difference. Yeah. I went over, I was looking at how many reviews other people get. And we do okay. But I looked at, like, Dan Carlin's. He's got like almost double ours. Now, he's been doing the show for double the amount of time. But I would like to pick up the pace. I think we should be getting much more reviews. Much more. I mean, fantastic. The show's fantastic.
It's true. It's true.
All right.
It's 646-257-3920. It's true.
All right. Don't be a loser. Just give us a review in iTunes. All right. We'll be right back after
this. It's the high energy thing to do.
Yeah. Sitting at the pen.